This week, we read The Lightning Thief, Chapter 11, Visit the Garden Gnome Emporium.
Auntie M always said there's no place like Gnome.
Hi, all my buddies, and welcome back to the Jackson 2. Only Percy Jackson TV podcast that comes with a free garden gnome in the mail.
Ooh. It says, no. Shipping and handling on that has to be outrageous.
Offer not valid in Kansas. No. You know what you did. Casey, I am William Mills. That is my name.
All right.
And your name is Casey Hills.
That's true. My name is Casey Hills.
It's funny because our names rhyme.
It's true. Normally you have to do some real, verbal calisthenics to get William and Casey to rhyme, but we pulled it off.
Yeah, no. Would you mind at all giving our gentle listeners a rundown of last week's episode?
Fucking probably. I was just editing that shit. That should be fine. It was a big one, honestly. So, there was a big, gear up sequence that I really enjoyed a lot, where, we learned about all the cool stuff they had on them. Everybody has their weapons, and, ABC has her Heidi hat and similar. And they got a pretty laughable amount of money, to support them on their trip across this great, big, beautiful country.
It was a very, what's one banana, Michael? $10?
Exactly.
Kind of scene?
Go see a Star War. And then they went to the bus depot, courtesy of Argus, the mini peepered man. They got on the bus, and then, oh no, it's all three Furies. Mrs. Dodds, Mrs. DeEven, and Mrs. DeNeither. And they proceeded to fuck shit up. PJ tried to sneak away unseen style, but then his hero pride would not abide this. So he unvisibled, and everybody rolled for initiative, and it went badly, and then Zeus just decided to do a TPK, rocks fall, you all die, roll new characters, and they ran off into the woods.
Yep, and we pick up with a fantastic line. In a way, it's nice to know there are Greek gods out there. Because you have something to blame. It's because you have somebody to blame when things go wrong.
Yep. That's honestly one of the benefits of religion that I don't think Christianity ever really understood.
Yeah, if you're not blaming the gods for your woes, what's the point of having gods?
Yeah. Dear God, what the fuck is a perfectly valid form of prayer. And I sincerely mean that. So, that's nice. What's the gang up to presently, William?
Getting lost in the woods of New Jersey.
Wandering along a river like three Depression-era escaped convicts, smelling of Dapper Dan.
Oh God, that's such a good... Don't have time. But that's a good movie.
You know, I always thought, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, would really benefit from the Fargo treatment. Like, there are other stories in that world, and I want to hear them.
Oh, yeah. No. God, I have such a weird relationship with that movie.
That's fair. Don't have time. They're all in varying degrees of shock because they were just in a goddamn car accident, which I think we can agree is a car accident that then exploded because of lightning.
A car accident plus monster fight.
Exactly, it's been an eventful day.
You know, for all the hype the kindly ones keep getting, they also keep getting dunked on pretty hard.
By 12-year-olds, yeah, they're not as good at this as their reputation would lead you to believe.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know what's happening with them.
No, nobody does. They're rusty, it's been a while.
I think they need to have a performance review.
Probably, they need some retraining, a recertification in their whipping stats.
I wish the Furies were this easy to deal with in the game Hades.
Yeah, ugh, for real. I was joking when I said it's been a while for them, but that's true, right? I mean, there's been this non-proliferation treaty, so since, World War II, they haven't had any official business on the human side of things. And I have to imagine that, hunting down other monstros and god types and stuff requires different skill and technique than hunting down a 12-year-old in modern New York does. So
maybe
they just haven't gotten a handle on it. Percy, excuse me, I ate a handful of M&Ms during the intro because I was trying to throw you off and I thought you'd call me on it and there'd be some good goofs, but you were a professional.
I didn't hear it at all.
Oh, okay. I was crunching right into the mic. I was just trying to be something of a little bastard, but...
No, I didn't hear it.
The peanut caught in my throat. So Percy and Annabeth get into it a little bit, which is a recurring theme. It's not what TV tropes would call belligerent sexual tension, because they're 12, but there's definitely, like, belligerent hand-holding tension, right?
I'll buy that.
They get into it because it was really brave, but also really stupid of him to jump into the action for a lot of reasons.
Brave, stupid, what's the difference?
It's all good, because if they lose him, that's the ball game. And, like, Annabeth is talking about how she is not gonna miss her goddamn shot at the real world because of Percy's ego. And that's a valid point, but I feel like it maybe deserves more attention than it's getting, that also if they fail in this quest, the world is probably gonna end.
Yeah, but you know what? Fair, because, again, 12-year-olds tend to be myopic.
Biologically designed for narcissism. Yeah.
Just the worst form of human being.
So she starts to tell PJ something, and they're interrupted by Grover, who's playing a completely ineffective song of pathfinding. Could you, did you get what she was, like, hinting at? What she was trying to tell him?
No.
Because I didn't.
I'll be honest, I have no idea what she was trying to tell him. The only thing I could think of is maybe she was apologizing for being rude about his dad. Like,
maybe.
But that's the only thing that really came up. Or,
yeah, I guess.
I don't know, maybe he looked cool when he stabbed the lady? I don't know.
Well, how could you help but do? Yeah.
In
any event, Grover's song of pathfinding turns out to maybe have not been completely ineffective, because it leads them toward the smell of delicious garbage food.
Oh, yeah. No. American diners are like the slowly beating heart of this nation.
God, it's so hunger-making, this chapter.
Yeah. And you know what? For saying he doesn't remember the road finding, or the find path song, they find themselves on a road pretty quick.
Yeah, they do. And PJ realizes that, like, the whole time he's been at camp, he's been eating a pretty lean... Well, he's been eating, like, the Mediterranean, like, diet for the most part, right? It's been, like, bread and olives and...
extra lean cut barbecue.
Exactly, which, and cheese and grapes and stuff, so...
I mean, he is hankering for some junk.
Exactly. This boy, he says, needs a double cheeseburger.
Which I knew as soon as I read it, it's like, oh, Casey read this chat. Casey.
Yep. Tell Winnie all the listeners say hi, William.
All the listeners say hi, Winnie. Shut the fuck
hi,
up, please.
Hi, Winnie. Winner, winner, chicken dinner. Dixie. Okay.
I would do almost anything to get you to shut the fuck up.
Is she there with you?
No, she's outside my door yelling.
That is through door?
Yes.
Wild. I feel really bad because I was editing the last episode we did, and I do a noise reduction on both of our tracks before I meld them, and it cut out most of her meow meow meows, but I think that one will probably stick. Anyway, they discover some business ruins, and one that has not yet skeletized, but is in fact a apparently living and vibrant garden gnome emporium.
They find a roadside, you know, kitsch cellar.
Yeah.
It's apparently just bustling on this abandoned two-lane road in the middle of New Jersey.
In the middle of Jersey, where there's, like, a busted-out, fossilized, like, gas station and a poster for a movie from the 1990s, they specify. As if the 1990s were not 6 years ago at the point this book was written. But still.
Yeah, but I mean, that's still quite a while for... Well, billboard to stay up,
especially when you're 12. Yeah. And so they are arrived at Auntie M's garden gnome emporium. I love emporia.
Emporium is one of my favorite words.
It's a good word.
Like it doesn't necessarily denote anything.
Nope.
But like there's a vibe to it.
Means whatever you want to do, big boy. Yep.
Like it's just a fancy way of saying shop.
It's the place.
It's a good word for shop.
Es la tienda grande and y elegante. I really love, I love the architecture behind different languages. Like, you and I have talked about, one of the things we love about German is that it's a Lego language, right?
Yeah.
Like, the word for wristwatch is literally, like, the word for hand, belt, clock. And the word for clock is just the word for hour and stuff like that. But, like, I really love that in Spanish, like, the word for shop, tienda, literally just means, like, the getting place. This is where you get the thing.
Yeah, it... Languages are good like that sometimes.
It's so good. It makes me so happy.
As they approach, Annabeth and Percy agree for the first time in the entire game, in the entire book. Let's see if they have food.
Let's see if they have food. They are, for once, the ones who are too distracted and focused on food to think about anything else. And Grover, God bless him, or Pan, bless him, is actually ignoring his stomach because there are some major weird vibes in this place.
Yeah, there is a monster stank about.
Yep.
So begins a 5-page thread of Percy ignoring his guides.
Yeah, exactly. Just ignoring every instinct. They've got every clearly obvious sign. Because you know what? Hamburger. And you know, who among us?
You know what? If I had just been in a car accident in the middle of the night and I was stuck in God knows where New Jersey, I would probably also be hungry.
Yeah, and someone offered me hamburger or awareness of danger. You know what? I was already in danger. It's fine. Like, you know, I'll take the hamburger. I don't have one of those. Grover is pretty freaked out by a statue that reminds of him, his Uncle Ferdinand, but he is not swayed by the allure of burgers the way Casey is, because he is a vegetarian, thank you very much.
Which, good for him, I guess?
Well, and that's the thing, like, he eats enchiladas in tin cans, and I am not familiar enough with enchiladas to definitively state this, but I am fairly certain, mm-hmm. I bet that enchiladas at least can have meat in them, right?
Usually. There are cheese enchiladas which don't, but they often have either... I'll be honest, most of the enchiladas I've had are chicken enchiladas.
That's fair. Well, I guess it depends on what kind of pretentious vegetarian Grover is.
I mean, he's eating tin cans. If he tries to put on airs, I'm reaching into the book and slapping him.
Yeah, that's fair. So they're greeted by a woman, this is pretty impressive, William. I didn't know if this tickled you the way it tickled me, but go ahead.
No, I just have a thing in my notes that just says, stop eating cans, goddammit.
Yeah, that's fair. Maya agrees. Grover will never need to worry for anemia. We can know that much, at least.
No. But what tickled you, sir?
Okay. Well, they're greeted by a woman in what PJ assumes is a burqa. And,
yes.
Like, this was 2005. I was real worried about where this was going to go. But
same. No, even in 2022, I would be slightly worried about it. It's like, oh, immediately, sir.
Faux real skis. But interestingly, he doesn't really have anything to say about that. What
no.
he has to say is that he looks at her hands and imagines that she is, quote, a grandmother who had once been a beautiful lady. What the fuck?
Which is probably the nicest thing he's ever thought about a person in this entire book that wasn't his mom.
And it's still a real asshole thing to say.
Well, I mean, yeah, kind
yeah.
of.
Implying that grandmothers cannot be beautiful ladies. It's, I don't know. It's just, and like, 12-year-old boy. Sure.
I mean, I've yet to meet a 12-year-old who thought, you know, grandmother age equals beautiful lady, but you know.
Yeah. And I don't know. Well, and that's, like, I mean, you can be a grandparent, like, if the math works out, you could be a grandparent before you're, what, 50? Like, it can be done. It's not a great idea, but it can be done.
No. But yeah, no, and...
Anyway, I'm just saying, like, it's 2005. She doesn't look like, God, who was it in 2000? Like, Hillary Duff, I guess. I don't know. So, as far as he's concerned, yeah, she's a grandmother. Whatever. Anyway.
I mean, they have been leaning on Hillary Duff these past couple chapters.
Oh yeah, that's so. Right. That's where that came from. I thought I just pulled that out of my ass. Nope.
We'll cut that to make you look smarter.
Nope. There's a lot of stuff I will cut to make myself look smarter, mostly like ums and uhs and stuff, but me being a genuine dum-dum, that's staying in, son. I'm straight with my listeners.
Phenomenal.
Although I did see a tweet yesterday talking about how weird it is that Hilary Duff and Zac Efron are the same age, because they seem to come from like two different eras, right?
No, maybe this is just me remembering it, but like, they were popular at the exact same time.
I don't know. Zac Efron, to me, well, you know what? I don't know from High School Musical, and maybe that's the divide. Because to me, the era of Zac Efron started with Hairspray.
I mean, that's reasonable.
Hairspray rules.
I know nothing of Hairspray.
Oh my God! Okay,
I know it's a classic musical. I know nothing beyond that.
Okay, I don't care much for the original movie, except that it was directed by John Waters, who is, of course, a master at what
Insane.
He does. What he does, I don't claim to understand. I just know that he's very good at it.
John Waters is insane. I am putting that down now.
And then, much like the producers, it became a stage musical, and then, much like the producers, that stage musical got a film version in 2007? With Zac Efron, Amanda Bynes, Nikki Blonsky, John Travolta as Mother Turnblad, Edna Turnblad, Christopher Walken, Michelle Pfeiffer. Fuck, that movie's good. Okay, William, listeners, we have a Patreon, and at one of the tiers on our Patreon, you get to choose a movie. You know what? I'm choosing one. I will become a donor to our own Patreon if I have to. I'm already paying for the hosting. Fuck it. Who cares? I am choosing Hairspray. We're watching Hairspray and reviewing it for this.
Sure. I've never seen it. I'll do it.
God, it's great! Anyway, I also haven't seen it in several years, and I bet parts of it haven't aged well, but that's the nature of media. Anyway, so
the lady...
Yeah.
Asks...
reasonable questions.
A reasonable question of, what are you doing here, children?
How come you here, children? And PJ, having just read a series of unfortunate events, says that they're circus orphans.
Yeah, oh yeah, no, so he does the thing in the D&D party where, you have people whose thing is supposed to be the talky bits.
Right.
But he gets excited and talks first.
Yep.
He spins a yarn about them being part of a circus caravan of orphans.
Yeah. You know, specificity, William. It's the soul of believability.
You know, and now they're lost in the woods.
Exactly, and Auntie M is filled with pity, for clearly Grover is Chabo the wolf baby in this version of events. So she invites them in, places full of creepy statues, including one that Grover is uncomfortably reminded of his Uncle Ferdinand by. But what's interesting is, it's not even just Uncle Rick lampshading it, it's PJ himself lampshading how dumb they're being.
Yeah. This is the first time where he really, brings back the fact that this is supposed to be like a, reminiscent book.
Exactly.
At the start, he's like, it talks about it like it's PJ writing the book later in life.
Right.
And this is the first time it comes up and he's like, go ahead, call me an idiot for walking into a strange lady's shop just because I was hungry.
Yep. I mean, who among us?
And you know what? I'm gonna say yes.
Yeah.
You are.
Well, although, he goes on to say, I do impulsive stuff sometimes, plus you've never smelled Auntie M's burgers. The aroma, she introduces herself as Auntie M. The aroma was like laughing gas in the dentist's chair. It made everything else go away. Which is fairly suspicious, but also difficult to notice if it's happening to you.
Yeah, so I think we can give a little slack in this food is probably somewhat enchanted.
Maybe. We don't know yet. There's no way to know until we take a giant bite.
And she takes them back, and apparently there is, like, a diner area.
There's... So they keep... I know this for a fact because I was reading these books before we started doing this. I was doing a run-up. Uncle Rick leans really heavily on the phrase snack bar. You know, like, they go on a trip just about every book, right, because something happens, and there's always a snack bar here and there. And I don't know when the last time Uncle Rick went on a transcontinental journey was, but, like, snack bars aren't a thing.
Yeah, no, you know what a snack bar is? It's a place you buy a pre-wrapped muffin on a train.
Exactly, or like a really grody old pretzel or something. It's not, like, a snack bar doesn't have a grill with fresh, delicious hamburgers and french fries. I wish they did.
Oh yeah, no, I would, you couldn't get me off the train if that was the offering.
Exactly. Like, what they had at Charlie Brown's, was not a snack bar. That was like a restaurant.
Yeah, that was
where you could get a bison burger.
Oh, Charlie Brown's.
Charlie Brown's, you racist local institution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a real shame.
Yeah, ain't it just? So, Grover admits that they have no cash, that they are but poor, destitute orphans. And she says, pshaw!
Your children.
Your children.
What? I'm not, and apparently orphans. I'm not gonna take your money.
No, it's fine. She saw that episode of Arthur, where Arthur took the wrong bus, or stayed on his bus too long, and ended up in a diner, and a nice lady gave him a hamburger, and only afterwards did he say that he didn't have any money, and she said, well, okay, that's no problem, I guess, it's fine. And she didn't want to put them in that position, so she got right out ahead of it. And so did Grover.
Yeah, and
it's the only episode of Arthur I've ever seen.
Okay, I've seen a lot of Arthur, but the thing is, I was 4, so I don't remember a goddamn thing.
I was never into Arthur, I was never into, like, the, is that a PBS show?
Probably.
I don't know, it wasn't my brand, but, anyway. Although, Fillmore was pretty good, and I think that was on the same station.
I wouldn't know.
Fair enough! Anyway... so things are still pretty creepy, and nobody seems to notice, but this bitch knows ABC's name somehow.
Yeah, no, she addresses Annabeth by name, and yep. No one seems to notice that they never introduced themselves.
No, it's fine. Don't worry about it. Everybody knows us.
And, you know, credit where credit's due, Uncle Rick does portray early teens as food black holes, and
yep.
He just... inhales this goddamn thing.
A tray. Wait a minute. I want to make sure I get the quote right because it's. I see it in my dreams every night. Let's see here. Our hostess disappeared behind the snack counter and started cooking. Before we knew it, she'd brought us plastic trays heaped with double cheeseburgers, vanilla shakes, and XXL servings of French fries. And William, I wanted to talk about this. It makes me really happy that. The insistent terminology is double cheeseburger because that is such a time and place snapshot. I'm a little older than you, so this might not have hit you the way it hit me, but like in the early to mid 2000s, there was this huge push from all the fast food places that there was like McDonald's had the Mighty Kids meal and Burger King had the Big Kids meal. And in all of them, you could get a double cheeseburger of your very own. How is this different than the double cheeseburger you could just order on the regular menu? Not important. Don't worry about it. It's for big kids. It's for mighty kids, William.
I mean, there is kind of an Americana rite of passage where
right.
You go where you transition from ordering off the children's menu
to
ordering off the adult's menu.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's very silly when you stop and think about it, but
so
is every childhood rite of passage.
Well, I was going to say, like all of them are. Yeah, I remember in the 5th grade when Mr. Blanchard took some of us out to Carl's Jr. for lunch because we'd won like a prize or something. I won like a contest. I don't remember what it was. And like I was in the 5th grade and also I didn't really know from Carl's Jr. So I just ordered a kid's meal because what was there. And all the other 5th grade boys made fun of me. For ordering off the kids' menu. And I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? I'm a kid. I don't pretend to snowboard, Sean Lawrence. Whatever.
That feels like a specific call out.
Okay, let me tell you. There's this kid, Sean Lawrence. And you know what? Yeah. I bet he grew up to be cool. Sean Lawrence, if you ever hear this, I have no beef with you in the present day. I was probably a little piece of shit kid. I don't fucking know. I was behind me eyes. I didn't see what was going on. But, yeah, like...
Hopefully Sean Lawrence turned out to be cool.
Hopefully Sean Lawrence turned out to be cool. I bet he did. Shane Bustillos, if you hear this, go fuck yourself. But, so like, in the third grade, because it was a very small school, and there was a big returning pool of kids every year, and like, Sean Lawrence was the leader of the cool kids, especially in third grade, and you know me, I'm a sucker for systems, right?
Yeah.
And if there's like a cool kids group, I want to figure out the rules to being in the cool kids group, and how do I do this? And so eventually, I rolled well on my persuasion checks to get into the cool kids group, and I didn't know what the rules were, and I wanted to know what the rules were, which is missing the point of being a cool kid entirely, but at one point, my shoes were untied, and so I wrote a note to Sean, and I slipped it over to him, and the note just said, "Do cool kids tie their shoes?" And he wrote back a note that said, and here I quote, "Sun tines." And it was at this point that I realized I had made a terrible mistake. And never thereafter did I give a shit about being one of the cool kids. So when Mr. Blanchard took us all out to Carl's Jr. and they all gave me shit for ordering off the kids menu because I was still 9 years old, I did not give shit one. Fuck you all. I got a toy. What did you get? Diabetes.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Anyway, speaking of Americana, there's another tradition of Americana, which is the small business withering and dying on the vine because they put in a highway. And that is what has come to pass regarding Auntie M's Garden Gnome Emporium. It's a real Radiator Springs situation. You okay over there, William?
I'm sorry, I need a moment. I don't know why that story just took me out, guy.
Sean Lawrence, you're cool. Shane Bustillos, you're a piece of shit. Sean Lawrence came into fourth grade. He was one of these kids who was like, yeah, I snowboard. Yeah, I'm cool. Yeah, what? Absolutely. I have my mom iron my shirt on my stomach. It feels good. And in retrospect, like, that's such blatantly transparent bullshit bravado.
Horse shit.
But at the time... Oh man, fourth grade was a hell of a drug. Desert Christian, how you doing? Mrs. Crossman. William, did I ever tell you that Mrs. Crossman was the first person I ever learned to manipulate?
Oh, I guess this is the tangent now.
We got time for this story. Yeah, this is the tangent. Anyway, as you are aware, I am a very nice person deliberately.
Generally.
Like, I'm a nice person by natural inclination, but also I do it on purpose, and I genuinely worry that that makes me manipulative, but everyone reassures me that if you're doing it to be nice, it's not a bad thing, so I try not to worry about it.
Also,
Mrs. Crossman...
Also, it is a general rule of thumb, if you're worried about being manipulative, you're not.
Fair enough, like, I've got like, a conscience, that's how you know, okay.
Like, manipulation has to be deliberate.
Okay, like, fair enough. So,
like, if you are not going into the situation to be manipulative, you're not. That's
okay. Cool. So Mrs. Crossman, was just a bitch on wheels, and Lord, did she hate you, boy, real, real bad. Because I was always reading in class, and so one time she wanted to embarrass me. She wanted to catch me like off guard while I was reading my like Wally McDougal book or Redwall or whatever it was. I think it was actually a Wally McDougal. It was too early for Artemis Fowl.
I have never heard of Wally McDougal.
We do not have time to get into Wally McDougal because that is a whole thing. That'll be next time. That'll be next pre-show. But anyway, you know what? Dozens of listeners right now, if they're the right age, just heard the words Wally McDougal and had an acid flashback to the late 90s. But especially if they went to Christian school. But okay, so I was sitting there reading my book, and she was going to try to catch me like unawares. So we were doing that thing where you go around the classroom and you all answer a question, and the next person answers the next question, like the workbook or whatever, right? So I found the one I wanted to answer. And right before we got to that point, I just picked up my book and like really blatantly started reading it. Like, ah, yes, Redwall. Give them what for, good shrews of the Gwossam? And she tried to like catch me off guard. She said, and number 42, Casey, if you would, what's the answer? Clearly thinking that she was about to murder me with embarrassment. And I just peeked down from my book and I was like, oh, I believe the answer was, Socrates. And then I just put my book right back up and went about my business like a king of men. It was beautiful.
That's pretty good.
To this day, one of my fondest memories, mostly because it's the only time I've ever really given an authority figure bullshit and haven't, like, suffered wrath because of it. Because what was she going to do? I knew the answer.
Yeah.
Play stupid games, win stupid prizes, lady.
Been chasing that high ever since.
God, ain't I just. Okie dokes, that is enough digressions, probably. So Andy M. is just watching them eat. And Grover is not into the food.
Yeah, no, he is quite solidly just no-selling this. It's like...
Correct.
I don't trust this situation.
I don't trust this food. I don't trust this lady. I hear a hissing sound that's setting me on edge.
Which, I mean...
So, at what point did the string begin to twing for you, William? Like, at what point did certain pennies drop for you?
About here.
Yeah, honestly. That's fair.
It's one of those things where it's like between the Auntie M and here, it's like, oh, okay, I know what's going on.
Certain things put themselves together. He hears a hissing that sets him on edge. Auntie M insists this is merely the fryer, and he has good hearing, and he insists that he merely takes ear vitamins, which is one of the funniest things I've ever heard.
Yeah, that's totally a thing.
Yeah, you know, ear vitamins. It's fine. Anyway, Auntie M is alone. Go ahead, good.
Yeah, Auntie M is alone. She's just watching them eat. And Percy, having very much enjoyed this burger, would like to take a burger nap.
Exactly. He is full of the cheese and presumably the bacon. He's feeling real dumb and real sleepy and real relatable. And both Annabeth and Grover are just twitchy and itching to go. But he is fully ensnared in whatever is happening here.
He is not even slightly thinking that this might be anything, like, this might be untoward. And he's like, so, statues.
Yeah.
And
what's that like?
Apparently statuary is very popular.
Exactly. And yet her business is struggling somehow. And those two things are not really explained together.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the highway, people don't really come around except, you know, this place is clearly vibrant and
well used. Have fresh ground beef that you... So what was she cooking before they got... Was she just making burgers for herself? That's pretty funny, actually.
I mean...
That's what I would do.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah. So she's alone. She once had two sisters, but the envy of a bad woman led to an accident and her sisters passed on. And now, quote, I alone have survived, but at a price, such a price. So PJ is feeling like real indebted to her. And in return for her hospitality, she requests a group photo of them to use as a reference for a future statue project. And, like, he thinks that Annabeth and Grover are being real fucking rude to this lady who fed them for free out of the goodness of her burka-clad heart.
Absolutely, yeah. No, he is fully just like, no, this is a nice lady.
What is wrong with you guys?
There is literally no reason to think this is anything other than a nice old lady, even though we were literally just attacked by old ladies.
Yeah. What are the odds of it happening a third time? William, I'm so glad you're my friend.
I am too.
So
it just reminds me of the what was it? It was a Monty Python sketch, Biker Grannies or something.
Okay.
It's an old Monty Python sketch of
sure.
The joke is old women acting like British punks.
Oh, that's very good. Like soccer hooligans.
Yeah, it was the 80s.
Thatcher. So Grover is a bit octopus.
I think I've said this multiple times, but like a really keen, like, growing of awareness into my adulthood was, going from knowing Thatcher as that lady that gets joked on The Simpsons to understanding exactly why everyone hates her.
One of the greatest monsters of modern history. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, all the scarier because she genuinely believed she was doing the right thing.
Yeah, no, like, she wasn't like Reagan who knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
She thought she was helping.
And no, she thought she was helping. She thought what the Irish needed was just to be less Irish.
Yeah, and then when she died, Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead went to number 2 nationally.
Yep. And you know what? At the time, I didn't understand that because I had not yet watched Netflix's The Crown, which is excellent and I recommend. And I, like, that was half a joke, but like Gillian Anderson plays Thatcher. It's incredible. It's a really, really, really good show. But, I didn't understand, like, when she died. I was like, okay, y'all guys are a little happy that someone is dead. And that feels weird to me. But then I remember that I had that bottle of Dr. Pepper Cuvée 1967 in my fridge for Fred Phelps. So, it was understandable from that aspect.
Yeah, absolutely. And, back to this, that's that tangent.
So the more we try to compress the tangents, the more they leak out is what I'm getting here.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I have to be at work in half an hour, and we have it's at least half a dozen tangents, and they've been good ones. And it just occurred to me that I didn't do a sound check before we started recording, and if this episode crashes or is unusable afterward, I am quitting this podcast. He lied. Anyway, so Grover is approaching a paranoia apex, and he is certain that statue over there is his Uncle Ferdinand. There's a definite weird vibe.
She asks them to pose for a picture. Grover is freaking out. Annabeth is pretty certain something hinky's going on.
Correct. And they decide it is time to act, because apparently PJ's not fucking gonna. Although, in fairness, it was he did it last time. He did the action last time and saved them from the Furies. So it's really their turn. Annabeth dons her Heidi hat and shoves Grover and PJ off of the bench, telling them not to look at Auntie M.
And a horrible rasping sound just sheens across the room.
Those snaky sounds. I am the snake.
Yeah, and she just goes full monstro.
I eat the mouse.
And they realize that it is not, in fact, Auntie M.
No.
M, as they had assumed. It was Auntie M.
As no.
In Medusa.
Medusa? It's not the Gone Girl. It's the Gorgon Girl.
Yeah, and,
fuck you!
That was a good one, but we don't have time.
Oh no! That's on me. No, we have time. We have half an hour. We're fine. So, yes, it is in fact Medusa, and 'twas Athena who enmonstrowed her, according to her, but ABC says that's some bullshit!
I mean, it's kind of more of a, we don't have time, we're running away.
Exactly. This situation really calls for more nuance than these circumstances allow!
And, you know what? Medusa offers kind of the same thing as Mr. D does.
What's that?
Did back in a few chapters back. She's like, do you understand what awaits you on this foolish quest, Percy?
Yeah.
What will happen if you reach the underworld? Do not be a pawn of the Olympians. You would be better off as a statue.
Correct. So twice now, someone tells PJ that death or bedolphining or whatever would be preferable to what he is willingly walking into. And he said, and she said, Auntie M said, that, like, she is gonna straight up murder Annabeth. That she will, quote, crush her statue to dust. Which, it must be admitted, is pretty metal. But that,
that is a move.
For real, but that she would just, like, keep Percy safe. She would just keep him here in an effort to save him from what's coming.
Yeah, which borderline implies that there's still some sort of life in the statues.
Kind of, and yeah, that's a real and I must scream situation.
Yeah.
That is pretty literally your boy's definition of hell, so I don't want to think about that too hard. But it is at this point that Grover, flying, closing his eyes and using a bat, attacks her. There's gotta be a joke there somewhere. He's flying, he's visually impaired, he's got a bat.
Yeah, no, I can't, just nothing there.
There's something. The pieces just won't come together. I workshopped it last night for a good piece of time.
You can see, like, a shape of it against, like, the night sky, but you can't quite make out any details.
You can't make the dots join quite up, and you say, look, that's a bear, and they're talking about, what the fuck are you talking about? That's a bear. That is clearly a dipper, so I don't know. But anyway, he manages to hold her off, and PJ, much to Annabeth's chagrin, has the superior weapon with Riptide and has to take the lead.
Yeah, she is quite unhappy about this, which is fair, because she's the one Medusa wants to kill.
Correct. She's got the ancestral beef with Medusa here. And, like, what would make Riptide better than being invisible and using a knife? I'm sure I don't know.
Or
but,
or why Percy can't lend her Riptide.
Well, exactly. Like, what's the problem there? But this raises an interesting question. So closing your eyes protects you from being Medusa'd.
Yeah.
So it's about you seeing the thing, not the thing seeing you.
Yes.
So if you, but that doesn't make any sense either, because her face was covered, and her eyes, it even said, because she was wearing what PJ thought was a burqa, but it said her eyes were exposed, right?
No. Her face was fully covered,
okay.
But you could see a glint behind it.
Okay, you see a glint behind her. Okay. So, like, can you be Medusa'd if, you know, like so many Rocky's horror, if you are invisible?
Probably.
I don't know.
I don't know.
Interesting question.
But being invisible does give you a lot of advantage. I'm realizing something.
What?
They have all of the artifacts that the original Perseus had when he went to kill Medusa.
They do?
Yeah, they have the flying shoes from Hermes. Yeah. They have a helmet of invisibility from Athena.
Oh, come on.
And they have a magic sword.
Oh, fuck off, Uncle Rick, you flash bastard.
I realized that literally now.
Uncle Rick, you rascal.
The only thing they're missing is a shield.
That's very good.
The only thing they're missing is a mirrored shield.
Oh, we've been rascaled, William.
Oh, that's good.
That's very good.
Hook it to my veins.
Yeah. So Annabeth gives him one of those, like, reflective garden balls that you always kind of wonder what the point is to watch her reflections in.
And wondering what the point of it is the point.
You know what? Fair enough. That's what reflection means.
Aha. Ah. Gotcha. And
that was a pun, or play on words.
There's a line that I love.
Well,
so Annabeth starts, just like explaining why the thing will work, and it'll throw it off a little because of the shape, right, and using a lot of technical words. And Percy says, "Would you speak English?" And she responds, "I am."
Yeah, for real though, she is like
because
she's just talking.
I have always hated that line because they're speaking English. You're just too stupid to understand what they're talking about. That's not the same thing.
No, and there's a real, like,
like, you can say, can you say that more plainly? But saying just speak English, you dum-dum.
But there's a real vein of, like, American anti-intellectualism in there, right? Where it's like, we don't need all your fancy words. We're simple, straightforward folk here, and it's good enough for us, and it should be good enough for you. I shouldn't have done that accent. That was mean. I'm sorry, anyone who has a similar accent. I was making probably unfair connections between, like, conservatism and anti-intellectualism and where people come from in the country. That was on me. I apologize. Shouldn't have done an accent. Those are cheap and easy and entertaining, and I should have done the hard work. And the hard work is saying that people from anywhere in the country
can be stupid.
can be stupid and say that, like, if you sound smart, it means you're too full of yourself and trying to get away with something and rah, rah, rah. But PJ is also, by his own admission, not a scholar.
No, he's pretty upfront about the fact that he's kind of a dum-dum.
Yeah.
Which is admirable. But, she just shoves the glass ball at him and says, go kill the thing. Don't look at it. Don't look directly at her.
Yes. And, to his credit, he succeeds. He does a bunch of stuff. There are some action scenes that, in retrospect, seem like they're pretty hard to describe in print.
Yeah, no, that's always been my issue when I've tried writing stuff. I don't know how to describe action.
No. They have a fight. It's fine. It's like Shakespeare. They fight. That's it.
They fight and they fight and they fight and they fight.
Well, yeah. You don't need any more stage direction than that. They fight, whatever that looks like. Go ahead.
And he swings the sword until he hears the sound of a monster disintegrating.
Correct. Except not all of her. The head remains as his spoils, like the Minotaur horn, which is pretty good.
Apparently, if you sever something off a monster, you get to keep it, which, to me, raises the question of, so what is the core thing?
What's the, where resideth Monstro?
Yeah, where do you get to severing, to the point where it doesn't stay?
Right, because it can't be a mass thing, because otherwise, like, I mean, most of the Minotaur is most of the Minotaur, right?
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know. It is not clearly addressed, but it's one of these ancient rules of war that is apparently immutable.
Yeah, he gets the head of Medusa and they put it in a bag.
They wrap it up in some shopping bags, and it makes me really happy that, like, what if it just landed face up, and they were like, whew, good thing we're safe, and, like, they all just got...
I mean,
like, just because of the way it landed?
I think I've seen a movie where something like that happens.
I think so, too. There's a series of British occult spy novels. I think I've told you about the Laundry Files.
Yes, and we had a conversation about it. They sound fun.
Yeah, they're really fun. And in one of them, there is what is referred to, its code name is Scorpion Stare. And it is essentially basilisk or gorgon technology that turns things to stone. And the mechanism explained is that it does some cool stuff with particles and wavelength, and it essentially turns 10%, a random 10% of the carbon molecules in something into silicon. And this results in a tremendous release of heat and energy and basically turns the thing into smoldering stone. And the British government has seen fit to load this technology into their closed circuit camera network.
Oh.
It's wild. They're very good books. Charles Stross, The Laundry Files. I recommend them.
With the danger abated.
Yeah. They proceed to loot the place, like any true D&D party.
And Percy asks, so what's this with Athena?
Yeah, and what are we talking about here? What's going on?
I have to put down my mythological credentials again.
Do it.
So the story they give... Medusa was Poseidon's girlfriend. They decided to meet in my mother's temple. That's
right.
Why Athena turned her into a monster.
Right. That's the family-friendly version. To the extent that that version is family-friendly.
That version is not from a Greek source.
Really?
The earliest version of that, the earliest iteration of that version I can find of the Medusa story is from a Roman source. It's from Ovid. Before him, Medusa was always depicted as she was a monster from the start, always had been a monster.
Really? That's interesting. Because in the Ovid version, isn't she, like, assaulted by Poseidon and then only in Monstro'd afterward?
Yeah, she was a priestess of Athena. Poseidon did what Poseidon does.
Right.
And she was enmonstrowed by Athena afterwards.
Yeah, through no fault of her own, obviously.
Which is usually what happens.
That's a pretty good rule of thumb in these books. Like, whenever anybody says, like, God X had a girlfriend, that means they sexually assaulted someone.
Often, yes.
Generally, yeah.
But yeah, the earliest version that is not... I cannot actually find an early Greek source for that. The earliest one is Ovid.
Well, so if she was always a monstro, then that would remove her revenge motivation, right?
Yeah.
So I guess narratively that mechanism was necessary.
Yeah, narratively that mechanism is why that's there. But well, I had to bring forth my pedantry.
Had to be done, by all means. And you know what? Uncle Rick would give you a high five for doing so.
My pedantry pedigree.
There it is, your pedantry pedigree. And it is perhaps worth noting, William, that the second series of books centers not around the Greek gods, but around their Roman counterparts.
Ooh.
So the line, as we know, between Greek and Roman is not as clean as our seventh grade teachers would like us to believe, you know?
There's definitely
overlap, and that is explored.
Oh, yeah, no, the Roman gods largely are the Greek gods with the serial numbers mixed around.
Yeah, that's what Rome do, baby.
they have a little snippet about this. And Grover's like, can we stop fighting for 5 goddamn minutes?
Yep.
And then Percy has an idea.
Yeah.
And it is a fantastic idea.
It's the best idea!
Well, first, she mentions doing a lot of business, and he does in fact find that she has been selling these statues to both Olympus and the Underworld.
Uh-huh, which is pretty fucked up if you think about it.
Yes, but it does give him an exact address for where to go to the Underworld.
Yes, it does. So he gets an address, a shipping address for hell. With some cash.
Shipping address to hell sounds like a post-punk band.
It really does. I'd listen to them.
What he does is he finds some packing slips for Olympus, and he sends Medusa's head to Olympus.
Uh-huh. With a message that says, best wishes, fuck you, XOXO PJ.
Percy Jackson. They're not gonna like that, Grover warned.
Nope.
They'll think you're impertinent. I am impertinent, I said.
Yes, very, very good.
And Annabeth, for once, doesn't find it in herself to say anything about that.
Nope. She picks her moment. God bless her.
I'm gonna be honest, I read that and it's like, this might be my favorite part of this entire book.
Well, yeah, it's when Percy stops being, like, a passive player, right? He stops just being pushed from place to place and starts acting on his own. This is the first turn he's taken with his own agency. And, say what you will, he did it with style.
Oh yeah, no, that is a declaration.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm here, motherfuckers.
She seemed resigned to the fact that I had a major talent for ticking off the gods. Come on, she muttered. We need a new plan. And that is the chapter. William, what's coming next?
What's coming next is...
besides me eating some M&Ms.
Me eventually learning to stop putting my book down. Chapter 11 is, we get advice from a poodle.
No, wait, this was chapter 11.
Oh, chapter 12, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Chapter 12 is, we get advice from a poodle.
Just like David Berkowitz, the son of Sam.
Sure.
Yeah. Anyway. So, go ahead and read poodle advice column next time. William, did you find yourself in this chapter, redolent as it was with good junks, did you find yourself a Brunner?
Yes.
Hit me. We need a Brunner theme song. I'll find something.
Mr. Brunner?
In my world, I'm known as Chiron.
Yeah, there are really only two moments that... there are really only two pieces of information that are in the running.
So you got a Brunner and a Brunner-up.
My Brunner-up, it's so difficult because I love them both so much. Mm-hmm. But I am going to put the Brunner-up as the fact that they fight Medusa whilst armed with the actual mythological equipment. Yeah,
that's really good.
Like all Uncle Rick had to do was describe Riptide as having a hook, and it would be perfect. It would be, like, mirror accurate.
The flaw that makes the masterpiece.
But, the runner-up, I have to give it to PJ, turning his little son-of-a-bitch energy onto a deserving target.
Uh-huh, that's very good!
Sending, like, going out of his way to send Medusa's head to Olympus, yep, specifically to antagonize the gods.
Yep, and actually signing it best wishes. That's, so good.
Which, you know, during the first episode, I went on a small tirade about how I don't like the, you know, pretending to be polite when you're not thing. But that was just chef's kiss.
Chef's kiss. Beautiful, beautiful, great, like, moment. Great moment of character development. And great to see. Because, like, the last chapter, as we discussed, was, like, kind of the real kickoff, right? That's when it, like, really started. And this is PJ kind of leveling up and coming to his own and shaking off the dust a little bit and deciding, like, look, if I'm going to have to do this, then I'm going to do it. Me. Not, like, the pawn of the gods.
Yes, absolutely. And it's fantastic.
It's great. Well, I too have a Brunner-up and a Brunner-actual. My Brunner-up is just, this is the first, but it won't be the last instance we get in these books of decaying America.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so just like Auntie M's roadside store just being the only thing, you know, within 40 miles, and she just gets fresh shipments of hamburger meat every week no matter what, and she can barely afford to stay open, and like the gas station nearby closed down so she can't even really leave because where are you gonna get gas? And just like I don't remember exactly if it's in specifically in this book or in the others, but they come across several more places like that, like just like the skeletal recession America fossils everywhere that at the time were beginning to pop up in the sort of economic decline because we had a forever war in the Middle East against no clear target to fund, didn't we? Anyway,
yeah,
different conversation. So that's my Brunner up because it's sad, and I didn't realize it the first time I read these because I was like 21 or some shit. So that was pretty good. But my Brunner actual also goes to PJ. So we got the daily double on that. Well done. But it's for once he's fed and satiated, and him tummy full, and him feel safe and happy, and him not trying to be killed by three old ladies. It's just one old lady, but he doesn't know that yet. He is full, and he looks over and he says, "So, you sell gnomes?" And that made me very, very happy for two reasons. First of all, obviously that's not a Gravity Falls shout out because Gravity Falls came afterward, but William, you've seen Gravity Falls.
Yeah, no, that is something I could see happening on that show.
Well, that did happen in the first episode. Like, the monster revealed itself to just be some gnomes who said, "So, we're gnomes," and that really, really set the tone. And the other, did you ever watch a program called Big Wolf on Campus?
Never even heard of it.
Oh my god, this was a staple of my summer afternoons when I was growing up. It's a Canadian program.
Of course
it's
it is.
It's not unlike Teen Wolf before Teen Wolf was a show. So there's this kid, he's in high school, and he's a werewolf, and he just is a superhero and saves people, and it's a comedy. It's fun. It's really good. I recommend it. I said, having not seen it in probably 20 years, I don't know if it's still good. Anyway.
It was good at the time, it might not hold up.
Exactly. But in every episode, every one without fail, at one point, one of his sidekicks, you know, like his girlfriend or his best friend or whoever, would get captured by the bad guy or the monstro or whatever and tied up, and he would have to come save them or whatever. But there would always be a scene with the hostage tied up to a chair or, you know, chained to a dissecting table or whatever. And they're kind of just waiting for something to happen. And the hostage will always turn to the monstro and say, "So, you're a Dracula. What's that like?" And the response, without fail, the response was something along the lines of, "Hey, it puts food on the table, you know."
I mean, I don't know what else you could ask for. That's a pretty
exactly
straight, straightforward answer.
It puts blood in my children. Anyway, so that's a very particular set of things that made me happy about that, obviously. That's very specific to me.
That's fair. That's good.
But still. And just like, PJ is rarely a force for politeness, but like, this lady fed us. There's no reason not to be nice to her. Let's ask about her stupid gnome shop. That also just made me happy. So,
and
go ahead.
It's a good thing that this is a Greek myth, because the Greeks didn't live on the sacred hospitality as much as other cultures. So there's a possibility Medusa would have really goozled herself.
That would have been much more interesting, actually.
Yeah.
If she couldn't have acted and brought harm to a guest under her aegis.
Yeah, like, and in some cultures, you are specifically obligated to come to their defense.
Exactly, because they could be Zeus. Who knows?
Ancient Greece didn't do that as much, so.
Right, but not none. I don't know.
Not none, but yeah.
So next time, go ahead and read your poodle noodles, please. And we will find out, was the head delivered COD?
Cranium on delivery.
What will somebody tell PJ he'd be better off being turned into next? A car? Some old Sega tapes? France? And how many times a day did Auntie M request a photo of someone describing them as statuesque and then wink at the camera? You can find us on Twitter at @_Jackson_TWO. Please, at us. We would love to hear what you thought of this chapter. We would love to hear your Brunners and your memories of Sean Lawrence. You can email us at thejackson2pod@gmail.com. I just checked it yesterday. We do not have any emails so far. The inbox is so very, very dusty and so very lonely. The tumbleweeds have died of isolation. It is quite sad. And also, if you should like to leave us a review and rating on your platform of choice, we would very much appreciate it. They're very helpful. In any and all instances of communication, please leave your name and or how you would like to be addressed, if you would, and we will read your communication out loud and or thank you for it or tear it to bits, as the case may warrant. William, what can the people do if they'd like to support us?
If you would like to give us direct support, you can do so on patreon.com/thejackson2, all one word.
That's us!
That's us, baby. There are four tiers. Four. For $2, you get early access to episodes, meaning that as soon as Casey can get them edited together, you can listen to them.
There's two of them shits on there right now.
Absolutely. For a $5, you get access to exclusive pre-shows for almost every episode.
What did we talk about this week's pre-show?
We talked about D&D, we talked about Dark Souls, we talked about a few really good comics that I might actually seek out.
Some good comic recommendations from Casey. We talked about why Casey has a goddamn hole in his floor.
Yeah, that's real interesting.
Because Domesticus has forsaken me. He has not found the scent of my sawdust a pleasing offering.
And if you... And that gets you is what you get for $5. For $10 a month, you get a monthly movie review of your choice.
Correct.
Subject to approval, Be Cool. We shall not watch Be Cool.
I'm
gonna
do it. That's on you. You do that on your own time. I'm not paying you for that.
$20 gets you access to uncut episodes, the max tier. That gets you every single iota of audio information that we put into this podcast.
Yep.
No cut jokes, no cut pauses, no cut ahem ahem ahems.
We bear our terrible souls to you.
If you really want just absolutely everything we could possibly give you, there it is.
Yep. So please hit us up there. You're not obligated to. If you'd like to, we'd very much appreciate it. Please get at us. We would love to hear from all of you. If you maybe want to tell a friend about the program, we'd appreciate it. I have to be at work in literally 1 minute. I'm logging on as we speak. And if I'm on the clock, I think that means I'm actually a paid podcaster now, which is pretty good. But so I will have to sign off. Go ahead and read chapter 12 for next time. Until then, be good to yourselves. Be good to each other. Wear your goddamn masks, because BA2 is on the rise. And eat the blue food. Bye, all our buddies. Kapla!
Ahem, hum. Rubber baby buggy bumper.
Rubber baby buggy bumpers. You stupid hippies.
Agnew.